Hello and welcome to Dyslexia Explored. Today we're going to talk about determination and dyslexia. The guest I've got today is a lady who is really local to where I live in Scotland. She grew up in the wilderness of Scotland and ended up training down in England and Bristol and becoming a PR marketing agent in London, but gave that up to do something more meaningful, became an English teacher. But while she was being an English teacher, and just before then, she discovered she had dyslexia at university, and she ended up writing as an English teacher and receiving 95 different rejections over 7 years until her fourth book finally took. And since then, she has had 11 books published and is a full-time publisher, and she has dyslexia and has a dyslexia story to tell, and I'd really love to hear it. And I think it's the sort of thing that parents, especially children who have that imagination in them and that desire to write, but they've got dyslexia as well, you'd be surprised how many authors actually have dyslexia. And we're going to delve into that again. We've mentioned this a number of times in the podcast, but here's another great story with dyslexia. I'd like to introduce to you Abby Elphinstone. It's great to have you here, Abby.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Abby, I love to just go right back to the beginning of your dyslexia story. This is Dyslexia Explored, so we want to explore your story. Everybody's story is a bit different, and there's themes, common themes, and something unique in each one, obviously. So what was life like before you discovered dyslexia? Could you give us an idea of what was life like before dyslexia, and what was your wake-up call to dyslexia?
Sure. So I grew up in the wilds of Scotland, as you mentioned, in Angus at the foot of the Glen. And so I spent my weekends jumping into icy rivers, building dens, climbing trees. And I spent a lot of time outside with parents who didn't push my life into organized pockets of time. They gave me a lot of time to run wild, to be bored. We were sort of just shoehorned outside, you know, get outside the house, go and play, go and build a den, go and imagine. And I think there's a lot of pressure on people or parents nowadays to micromanage their children and to be the best parent they possibly can, which means throwing every possible opportunity child's way. But I think there's something powerful to be said for letting your children have space and time to create their own fun and their own ideas. So I had a childhood where I was free to imagine and create. And it was sometimes physical, building a den, making flower potions out of flower petals and mud and water and things. But it was also stories. I had a lot of time to be bored, and out of this boredom fueled this sort of desire, this hunger for stories and imagination. So sometimes they were just in my head whirling around. Sometimes I'd write these stories down with my siblings, or we turn them into plays and dress up and act them out. So I knew that from a young age, stories mattered to me. I wasn't particularly good at reading aloud. When I read aloud, I noticed that the words jumped around, or I got such terrible fear of reading aloud because it didn't come out perfectly that I didn't want to do it. I didn't know I had dyslexia, and I loved stories and reading. So I thought someone like that couldn't be dyslexic. Or maybe I think when I was that young, I didn't even know what dyslexia was. But certainly at school, I remember that I had to put in 3 times as much effort as some of my peers to get to the same place as them by the end of the lesson. If a teacher spoke in the lesson rather than writing things on the board or giving me a textbook to visualize what I was being taught, it simply didn't go in at all. So I had to work really, really hard at school to kind of stay afloat. But English lessons were my haven. I had a fantastic teacher, and she didn't push me to read aloud in class. She seemed to realize that I had good ideas and I loved narratives, that some processing issue or something was happening along the way, but nobody brought it up. I'm 38 now. Perhaps when I was at school, I don't think dyslexia was talked about as much. I've got 3 siblings. 2 of them are also dyslexic, and they actually were tested at school and they got extra time and they understood a bit more about how to deal with it. But no, I sailed through school. I baffled through school, not knowing. And as you say, it wasn't until I got to my first job that my boss said, oh, there's some real processing issues going on here.
Right. Well, can we pause there before you get to the wake-up call? Because that's interesting that your siblings were identified with dyslexia, but you weren't. And this is so common.
Is it?
Yeah, because, I mean, the amount of guests I've had where they had siblings and parents who had dyslexia, but they didn't get identified until adulthood. And I think I'm moderately dyslexic. I used to think I was just maybe mildly dyslexic, just had a little touch of it sort of thing, you know? And you kind of think, well, I might be a little bit dyslexic. And then you go and get tested as an adult and they go, well, you're a little bit more than mildly dyslexic. You're moderately dyslexic. It is actually affecting your life. But then you get people who are extremely dyslexic and it sort of blares out at you. And I think often siblings who show more of the dyslexia traits more extremely, you compare them and you go, well, they're not like that, so they can't be dyslexic. You know, I wondered if there was some of that in your family.
I think there was, because I think I'm extremely iron-willed, like really stubborn, but also really determined. And I think if you've got a determined dyslexic, it's hard to identify they are dyslexic because they're so adamant that they're going to reach the same place as their peers that you sort of cover it up and fudge things over. So my sister is really bad at spelling. It's such an ostensible thing. You look at her writing and you think, or she misuses like a malapism. You know, she uses the wrong word in the wrong context. And it's obvious, glaringly obvious. It's similar with my brother, actually. Whereas with me, perhaps it wasn't as obvious, but it was all happening behind the scenes.
Yeah.
I think maybe the determination sort of masked it a little bit. And half of me thinks I'd love that someone would have noticed at school and so school life would have been a bit easier and that I wouldn't have felt so insecure about the way my mind worked, the way I learned. But I think then years later, when I came to writing and I was knocked back so many times, you know, 96 rejections from agents over 7 years, I think that dogged determination that I learned as a child meant that when I faced all these rejections, I thought, no, I can keep going and I can still get through this and get to where I want to get. It might just take me years and years, but I can do it. So I think I take that hard-won grit and determination over an easy life any day. So
A lot of entrepreneurs with dyslexia say exactly the same thing, you know, that the knocks and the rejection and the difficulty and the requirement to find workarounds and you know, just get there in another way and adapt is a skill that has been trained into them all their young life so that when they start into their entrepreneurial life, it's just second nature for them to do that.
And I think as a writer, all you need to write a story is an idea that nobody else has stumbled across yet. So you're more likely to come across this idea if you look at the world sideways, if you look at it in an unusual way, in a way that not everybody sees. So if you are used as a dyslexic person, used to viewing the world in a different way and navigating problems and problem solving, then I think it goes hand in hand with writing. So on the surface, it may seem, you know, writing is about spelling and grammar and punctuation. It is about all those things. But stories, first and foremost, are about ideas and imagination. Yes. And that is what I think created, sorry, dyslexic people have in spades.
Yes. So let's go back to where we left the path of what was your wake-up call? What woke you up to dyslexia? It's normally a person.
I think it was my boss who said, you're really keen and you're quite good at what you're doing, but you're really nonsensical in your processing. And sometimes I'll say something to you and I can see your face just glaze over. And she said, she herself actually, I think it was dyslexic. That's what it was. And I think she said, I recognize a lot of myself in you. And then I got a dyslexia test and I was like, ah, yes. And did it shift things? I don't know. Maybe it made me a bit easier on myself. And I think anything you can do as an adult to understand why you do certain things or why you think the way you do is probably helpful. So yeah, I think it hasn't changed the way I go about life, but I think probably it made me easier on myself and also probably more empathetic to others. And it certainly helped when I then became a teacher. And I taught children just like me who were sitting there eager to learn, but sometimes being left behind. And so definitely I think it helped for teaching.
How great is that? A dyslexic English teacher. Fantastic. Yeah. And there are those. It's surprising how many teachers themselves are dyslexic and actually how many teachers are dyslexic and don't know it.
Oh, so much more that I think. Yeah. And I don't know if I would have said anything in my interview, I'm dyslexic as well. I think it's sort of, I got the job and then it came out afterwards or something, which is awful because it shouldn't hinder your ability to teach. And if anything, as I said, it makes you more empathetic. It makes you more understanding and aware of what other children are going through.
I used to be a primary school teacher, and the children got, I went with the same class. It was in the Rudolf Steiner School. I went with the same class for 4 years, and you actually go with them for 8 years, all the way through their primary education with the same teacher.
Yeah.
So it's like a real bond you build with them. And there was one girl in the class, Abby, who was really good at English, really good at spelling. So she got assigned the proofreading task for me as the teacher. Sometimes I would make inadvertent spelling mistakes on and she'd go, "Snom de Ron, Mr. Darius." And I go, "Yeah?" She says, and I'm like, "Spelled oh, right, wrong, okay, yes. Oh, right, yes, rub it out and carry on." So I think sometimes having a bit of transparency helps because I think knowing that you've got dyslexia basically means you can say to people, I think this is really useful when you're an adult in the workplace, you say to people how you disclose your dyslexia is very important, that you say, I'm really good at solving problems, identifying situations ahead of time, getting things done, practical projects, getting things across the line, but I'm not so good at some spelling and grammar because I'm dyslexic. And people go, right, okay, I get it. It's worth having that downside for this upside. But often we just present with the downside and leave it at that.
Yeah. No, I think it's definitely a wider picture. It's not, here are the failures. It's, here's the whole picture. And this is, I think there are certain, exceptional skills that you only sometimes have when you're dyslexic. And so many authors are dyslexic when you dig. You sort of realize, it sort of goes hand in hand.
Oh, really? Tell us more. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot more people with dyslexia than know it. And there's a lot more people with dyslexia that disclose it. So do you come across other authors that you know are dyslexic and they don't know that they're dyslexic, or they do?
Most talk about it if they know. Proud to say, almost as if I've got dyslexia and I think it's an advantage in writing. I think I'm at an unfair advantage when I come to writing, because I'm already looking at the world in a way that other people aren't. And so, I think I'm Cressida Cowell, who writes the How to Train Your Dragon book. I think she might be dyslexic as well. But there are big names, Tom McLaughlin, children's authors, who are writing with dyslexia. So I do think it goes hand in hand. And they are very open, and they're proud to talk about that. And, they can come into classrooms. And I always say, when I go and speak to children, I'm dyslexic, I struggle with ideas. I say, when I sit down to write a book, my ideas are a tangled knot. They're totally a mess. And then I tell them how, as an author and a dyslexic author, I draw my way into my stories. And please, I talk to them all about
that. Yeah, tell us more about that. I like that phrase, writing with dyslexia. That's a beautiful phrase, actually, writing with dyslexia. It shifts emphasis so that you're writing, but with dyslexia. Rather than dyslexic writer it just shifts the emphasis. Yeah, love that.
Exactly. It makes it more natural, more fluid or something, that it's all just, this is what we're doing, and not a label, but a sort of, it just happened to be with dyslexia. I think I didn't realize this until I think a few books in, actually, into writing, because my first books were really messy, loads of different drafts and loads of rejections. Once I worked out how to construct a children's book, I realized there was a thing I was doing every time, and that was doodling my way into my stories. So I'm a real visual learner. So when I sit down to write a book, then my latest book is called Saving Neverland, and it's like a modern retelling of Peter Pan. And it's set in an icy world, or an icy island called Neverland. The original Neverland was tropical. I made my one all icy and full of snowbound mountains, forests are covered in icicle. So all I do is get a piece of paper and I draw the world I want to write about. So I knew that this was going to be a snowbound island. So I drew places that I think children might like to visit if they were in a snowbound island. So some Shiver Peak Mountains, a river called Dragon Tail River that's covered in ice, waterfalls that are frozen, the Silver Staircase, a staircase of iced boulders leading up into the mountains. And then once I've got some places within this setting, I get another colored pen, and I draw a journey through this world. And then I just imagine things happening along the way to a main character on this journey. So there was a writer called Vladimir Nabokov who once said, the writer's job is to get the main character up a tree. And then once they're up there, chuck rocks at them. And that's what I do. I draw this world. I get a different kind of pen, draw a journey. And maybe I think maybe Martha and Scruff are kidnapped in the Neverwood. Maybe they find something mysterious in Smuggler's Pocket, a deep, dark cave. Maybe they're ambushed by somebody in the Shiver Peak and reunited with an old friend at Dragontail River. And then suddenly you've got a story and it's all visual. You know, it's this. And then once I've got that, that gives me the scaffolding and the confidence that I need to then launch into the story and think, I've got this, I can write it. Some writers, and many writers who I adore, launch straight into their books. And that's wonderful. Like David Armand, who wrote Skellig, said it was effortless. He said he just put pen to paper and just wrote the whole thing almost as a finished book straight away. I'm so seethingly jealous of someone who can do that because I need to, yeah, really see the story first. And then I feel so confident to write it. And I can go in different directions once I've got that map. But I definitely need that. And so I tell children who are wanting to write a story and they say, well, I'm dyslexic and I've got all these ideas. How do I turn them into a book? When I said, draw your way in. And that usually helps them.
Fantastic. Fantastic. That is wonderful. I actually, one of the companies I own, we teach children how to mind map stories by doodling.
Yeah.
Do you ever do mind mapping?
I do. I'm just trying to think, where's my book? So I go everywhere with a notepad.
Uh-huh.
And just yesterday, so I'm writing a brand new book called Ember Spark, Vet to Magical Beasts. And I'm trying to come up with a villain. And I've decided my villain is unoriginal, boring. I want it to be better. And so there's Jesper Hornswoggle, the name of the villain. And then I'm starting, it's small now, but a small mind map. So yeah, I regularly do mind maps. There's actual maps. It's me drawing my way into stories. But this whole notepad, yeah, is filled with mind maps. I didn't realize that was a strategy that you used, but definitely, yeah. If I write about a character, like in this book, Martha Pennydrop, I'll write her name in a circle. Then I'll put loads of dashes around it and I'll be like, likes this, hates this, finds this really funny.
Yes.
What's her motive? What's her, you know, and then I build out from there. So definitely mind maps help as well.
And fantastic.
Weirdly, so do you do, you won't do this. This will be weird. I do bar charts. So when you write a story, you want it to have this ebb and flow of action that is gathering pace throughout, that's building to a crescendo, and then there's a finish. And so sometimes, I guess because I maybe don't have the confidence or I worry that my ideas are going to spiral and get too complicated, I draw a little chart of action, which is like, you know, it's like a sort of bar chart that rises and falls. So I can see visually, okay, my book has that structure that I want. And then I rise it towards the end. So again, it's that real sense of charting. And it sounds so mechanical when I say it out loud. And I want to say that stories are so fluid and I just come up with the ideas. I mean, maybe if I didn't have dyslexia, then that would be the case. But I do think I do a lot of techniques that give me this confidence and give me structure.
Well, it's kind of like pruning a tree.
Mm.
If you've got lots of growth of ideas, sometimes you need to prune it down to the best bits. And so the bar chart is your way of kind of pruning down or distilling or viewing it with a different kind of heat-seeking lens or, you know, it just identifies it according to action, and you can view it through different lenses, as it were, and analyze it through different, reflect on it, really.
Yeah, I definitely think that's what it is. It is, as you say, it's a tangled beast.
Yes.
a dyslexic writer's brain is a mess. And then it is this bringing things down. And I think if there's one thing I've learned over the years as a writer, as a published writer, is that sometimes it's the really simple ideas that are written well that are the best stories.
I'd love to talk more about that, because you mentioned your first three books, and then it was the fourth book that got... So the first three books you wrote got all of the rejections. And did they get published at all?
No, with good reason. Even my mother was like, oh, it's just those in a drawer.
Oh, gosh.
They weren't good enough. And I'm so glad I didn't get published with them, because as a writer, you've got one shot to debut. And if you don't sell on that first time, you're unlikely to get your contract renewed. And as a writer, it's about getting your contract renewed so that you can be a writer for life. So they wouldn't have been good enough. But the agents kept saying things like, this book isn't the right book, but there's something about this storytelling that's intriguing, that's funny, or you made us laugh out loud, which is really hard to do as a writer, or, you know, you created something really original here. So the whole book, the structure, they often said, was completely off. And the way the book was put together was too wielding and huge. But I borrowed since then elements of those failed books and used them in the books that have worked. So my fourth book was a book called Sky Song. And I went out to the Arctic, dog sledding across snowy valleys and watching orcas dive for herring. And I went also to live in Mongolia with the Kazakh eagle hunters. I heard that there was one eagle huntress, a girl who trained a golden eagle to fly and hunt for her, in a tribe full of men and boys. And I thought, oh, this one girl. So I went out to meet her and to live with her, and she became this heroine here. But I ended up borrowing ideas from failed books and putting them into this book. So this land in this book is called Erkenwald, and that was the name of the very first kingdom I ever wrote about. And Erkenwald actually came from a street sign in London. So I find story ideas absolutely anywhere. I've named characters after shower gels. This is a shower gel from TK Maxx called Pecksniff. And the girl in The Dream Snatcher, and this was my debut, the first book I had published, is called Moll Pecksniff. So she's named after a shower gel. But I tell kids this when I do talks, because, you know, you can have things that you think in life are incidental and or that just make you giggle as a one-off. And then when you come to write a story years later, you find yourself borrowing the name from the street sign in East London or the shower gel in TK Maxx. So yeah, the ideas failed. Sorry, the books failed, the young earlier ones. But some of the ideas were fun, and so I scooped them out.
And so what I'm hearing from you is that from the first three, the unpublished books, to the first book, you discovered a simplicity in your writing and a focus in your writing. Is that what made the difference?
Yeah, I think so. So yeah, the first book was The Dream Snatcher. I read and read and read what children were loving right now, what books were selling. And I started to understand a bit more about craft and about shorter chapters, with each chapter being a hook that if you're reading before bed, you think, oh, just one more chapter before bed. And it hooks you into the next thing, like the characters overcome certain obstacles and then another difficulty presents itself. So I started to understand about structure. I still think, though, because this is my first book, this is my 11th, so this is my most recent one, I've kept honing. It's like anything, practicing the piano, being a football player. I think you get better and better with practice. So I think now the later books are probably better written. And the understanding how my brain works more. I know what to do now when I sit down and write a book. And I think with The Dream Snatcher, because it was my first one, I was still firing out into the dark. But certainly it was better than the first three in terms of getting an idea that was more concise.
Yes.
And following that through. Yeah.
One of the things I've noticed with a number of students that I've taught in the past with dyslexia and how to map their ideas out is that they get stuck in the flow of consciousness, that they're really just describing everything they see all the time. Oh, there's this happening over there. There's that happening over there. And it's like they're standing on a hill looking out over a landscape, and they're just describing this battle and a kingdom and this over there and that. And you're like, this is fantastic, but what's actually happening? And this ability to zoom in and create a pathway of a story through it that stops it being just a stream of random consciousness of ideas into flow, a proper pathway of a story. What they have naturally is the ability to describe the landscape, but then what needs to be learned is the ability to block out certain things to focus in and zoom on the next key step in the story.
That's so interesting you say that, because the first criticism I had for the books I was writing initially were editors saying, you're describing too much, you need to focus on the story. And they told me something that stayed with me forever, is they said, imagine your main character has a torch on their head, a head torch, and they are lighting the setting up as they go through the story. So don't just see the whole picture and describe every single thing that you can see. And I think because dyslexic writers do that, they're like this and this and this. Imagine your character with a head torch. What do they say immediately in front of them? What's important to their story? And when they said that, that really illuminated writing and not getting bogged down by the surroundings. And I think to streamline stories now is something I'm learning to do much more. So things like, if you write, she held on tight to the side of the balloon, the hot air balloon, you could actually get around by saying she clutched, because clutching is always tight. You don't clutch in a loose way. So I always now go through when I'm editing my books and I strip words out. I'm like, I could use one word for those two. What am I really saying here? What's essential to the story? And I think that's helped the books, I think, become better.
Do you do that with characters as well? Do you sometimes cut out characters to simplify them as well? Like, yeah, have less characters?
Yes, definitely. When I wrote Saving Neverland, I don't know if you remember the original Peter Pan, there were the Lost Boys.
Yeah.
I didn't want the Lost Boys. I wanted the Lost Kids, because I was like, why can't there be girls in Neverland? And the original Peter Pan ends with Peter telling Wendy Darling's daughter, you can come back to Neverland to do the spring cleaning. It's like, this is a terrible message to young girls, telling them they can go on the adventure for the housework. So anyway, I rewrote the book showing that young girls could be on the adventure and could be a central part of it, as well as the boys. So the Lost Kids originally was a big collection of kids in Neverland. And then I was finding there were too many kids that I couldn't keep hold of them. And I couldn't describe them well because there were so many. I needed to get around all of them. And the minute you name a character in a book for children, the children think, oh, that's important. I've got to remember it. But if you're naming sort of 30, kids are like, I can't remember them all. I'm trying, but I can't. So I then stripped it right down. And I think this book's illustrated throughout by a lady called Geraldine Rodriguez. And she's drawn all the Lost Kids. There they are. There, I think there's 1, 2, 3. And then there's Peter and Martha and Scruff. So once I paired it back, suddenly I could then get into the characters much more. So 100%, if you are teaching children with dyslexia or whatever, helping your child do a homework, a dyslexic child do a homework, and then writing a story, is to say, pair this right down, not just in terms of the language, but in terms of the characters. And that will help them sort of not lose a grasp on it, you know, just being too tangled.
This podcast is sponsored by DyslexiaProductivityCoaching.com, which helps you organize yourself creatively with a productivity system for Apple devices.
Do disparate.
Fantastic. So let's follow the story of your dyslexia story. You didn't know you had dyslexia in childhood. You found out in early adulthood. You then became an English teacher for how many years?
So I was 22 when I left university, and I was in PR and marketing for 2 years. Ended up feeling it was just, for me, really soulless and vacuous. I just didn't believe in it. And I think possibly being dyslexic, because everything's such a struggle in terms of ideas and concentrating and retaining information, you've got to be passionate about your day job. It's hard to do it. So I thought, right, I need to shift. And my mum said, I think you'd be a great teacher. And so I actually moved to Africa, to Tanzania, to teach first, partly because I really disliked working in PR and marketing and I wanted to get away. And I love wild places. Having grown up in Scotland, I'm always thirsting for adventures in like the Arctic or the jungle or something. I went out to Africa and I taught English out there, but I started writing. And then I came back when I was 20, whatever it was, 4, something like that. And then I went into a school and started teaching and writing. And then it was 7 years of writing and getting rejected. And I think it was 5 years total teaching, 4. Yeah. Once in a school in the sort of home counties, which was lovely. And then I taught in a school in London, and there were loads of brilliant schools in London, but this one just didn't feel, I didn't feel particularly happy. I didn't like the learning ethos. There were some wonderful children and some brilliant members of staff, but the whole thing together didn't really work. And I came out of teaching then and write and wrote. And I tutored a lot of dyslexic children and did that to sort of keep my income going. And then when I was able, when the books took off, I was able to drop down on the tutoring. And then I focused on being a writer full time.
So what would you say are your biggest challenges being a writer, being a person with dyslexia, being a writer with dyslexia? You've talked about some of the advantages. What would you say are your personal challenges that you've faced?
I get frustrated with myself quite easily. So if I'm being interviewed, just sometimes I have like a complete mind blank, or I find it really difficult to retain information that I've learned that I really want to talk about for a certain subject, but I get nervous on the spot. My ideas get big and tangled and I can't find my way through. I get frustrated because some people seem to just be so articulate and find out exactly what they want to talk about straight away. Yeah, I get frustrated that I don't hit on the right word straight away. And I think in creativity and in writing, there's a tendency to look sideways at what other people are doing, which is either going to make you feel inadequate because you think, oh, I'm not as good as that person. Arrogant because you're like, yeah, I'm definitely better than them. And then with having dyslexia as well, you definitely look sideways because you think, oh, they find it so easy to write so many books a year. But for me, it takes much longer. And I've got 3 kids under 6 years old. So that also holds me back in a wonderful way, but also it can be frustrating. So I think probably the answer is that I get frustrated with myself, but I've learned to look straight ahead, not sideways, what other people are doing. And that's where, you know, you go. And my dad said something really helpful to me when I started writing. He said, remember your goalpost. He said, you wanted to write a book. You wanted to walk into a bookshop and see your name on the spine of a book. You've done. He said, everything else is a bonus. And I think that was really healthy because for my marriage as well, because you become restless. And I think with creativity, there's no finish. You could always keep writing. You could write something better.
Yes.
You could get it optioned for TV. Netflix could make a smash hit out of it. You know, it's about being thankful for what you've got and hungry for more, but not in a sort of insatiable way that leaves you feeling unfulfilled and tetchy because you're always reaching for something. I think I have to tell myself, it's fine the way you think and the way you process information, and you know, you've done well to get where you are, and just keep going and keep enjoying it, basically.
Yes. Yes. So it's that feeling of, I could, if I was like such and such, I could do so much more.
Yeah. Or I could not get my words in a tangle if I don't know, on Blue Peter or something. I did Blue Peter and luckily I didn't get my words in a tangle, but I only had a couple of words to say. I mean, I didn't realize how scripted it is on TV if it's not live. And it was live. And so we were all given like a couple of lines that we had to say. And there was a little dot drawn on the stage where we had to stand on the dot and say the line. That terrified me because my brain sometimes will just completely implode and I'll say the wrong thing or I won't say anything at all and I'll just stare. And so I wish that I could just be a bit more relaxed about that kind of situation, or maybe going on live TV for anyone is terrifying though. So maybe
yes.
Well, yeah, I wish I could just.
Well, what you're describing is the difference between sequential learning and simultaneous learning, or simultaneous thinking and sequential thinking. So a person who's really articulate and systematic will develop a very systematic argument that follows one particular or discussion that follows one track. And that really suits well to sales pitches or broadcasting. Or
I'm the opposite of that.
But you are simultaneous. You're kind of seeing everything simultaneously. And you're kind of like, right, I will talk about whatever seems more relevant to the conversation.
Yeah.
In this map of understanding and bring it in. Whereas someone else saying, like a politician, I've got my set thing to say and that's it. And I don't care about whatever else is going on. And some people are very sequential and some people are very simultaneous, scattered. Yeah. Yes. And and so often with dyslexia, because I think dyslexia is a processing difference to other people. We process information differently and we don't process it in this same kind of sequential way. We don't sequence things in the same way. We don't remember sequences in the same way. We're not thinking in a sequential way. We're thinking in a much more a mapped way, simultaneous way, trying to observe the interrelationship between ideas and the map of meaning that's going on.
Yeah.
And that's where we're really good narrators and storytellers, etc.
Yeah.
But that's fascinating to hear it playing out in your everyday life, you know?
Yeah, no, I really feel that. And I can get on a stage and be interviewed in front of thousands of kids. And actually, funnily enough, in front of kids, I find it easier. Uh-huh. I don't tend to fluff my words or muck things up. I don't know whether it's partly because I used to be a teacher, so I feel quite confident in that environment. Like I've got a talk this afternoon to 15,000 children, and it's a virtual talk. They're all being live streamed all across the country. But that won't worry me. And if I was in front of them, 15,000 children, that wouldn't worry me. If I was in front of 15,000 adults, I wouldn't turn up because adults are stuck passive listeners, they sort of sit there going, you know, slightly on their phone, slightly not engaged. Whereas I find that children listen with like their jaws slack. They're like, you know, and you talk to them about going to the Arctic and they're there with you. They're on the stage. And I find I'm much more confident talking to kids. And I prefer in-person visits where you can really time the humor and you've got them with you. And it's, you know, I really enjoy that. But it doesn't happen nearly so much that I get sort of brain freeze or fog or mumble my words or fluff them if it's children. But with adults, I think I possibly am always measuring myself against them. I'm like, they don't think like I do, or, you know, they're far cleverer than I am. And it makes me feel quite inadequate. And I think that probably panics me even more. Whereas with children, I'm like, you guys, you want me to do well. You're fine.
Yeah, fascinating. I think, I don't know about you, but I feel that often people with dyslexia really thrive on feedback, instant feedback from a person. You know, it's like, it's this map of meaning that you've got around you in your mind. When you're speaking to the person and you get some feedback, oh, this is working, I'll tell you more about that. Oh, that's not working, I will adjust, and so on. So you can sort of adjust according to the response you're given.
Totally. I absolutely thrive on positive feedback, and every bit of feedback that's positive, it gives you that cushion to be like, oh, okay. And then you can go further and further. I didn't used to like criticism as a child, I don't think. But then I can't have hated it that much for then to go through 7 years of being rejected and 96 rejections, you know. But I definitely do. I respond better and thrive on praise rather than someone saying, well, it's not good enough, you know.
Well, I mean, is that completely accurate? Because, you know, yes, you respond to praise. But do you also not also respond to no feedback or negative feedback or neutral feedback or negative feedback? Let's just say neutral. Oh, this isn't quite hitting the mark. I'll adapt slightly until you get that positive. I mean, you've clearly shown that in those 7 years in the way that you've written and responded and adapted to the feedback you've got.
Yeah, possibly, because it was linked to passion as well. Like, it was writing, I can't believe it's my job to sit down and invent and come up with ideas and stories. It feels like a real luxury, a real privilege. It's hard work. You know, touring the country away from my kids is sometimes difficult, but it's because I enjoy it so much. Maybe it's easier to take criticism on something you're so passionate about. And you can see, you're like, I know that they're going to make the book better. So listening to editorial feedback and being like, you're right. I can hear that and think it is worthwhile me changing that to make the book story better.
Yes, I get you. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we talked about the challenge and, you know, the reward of that challenge. You know, we've had What Life Was Like Before, discovering dyslexia effect on your life. Then the dyslexia, was that in the marketing phase? Was that your marketing?
And sort of realizing that possibly, and then saying, you know, you're unbelievably creative. Go and you can pursue careers that are to do with creativity. I did those ISCO tests, Morrisby tests, when I was younger, that tell you your skill set. And it didn't throw up that I was dyslexic on that. It wasn't testing for that. It was testing for what your skills are. And then it, by some algorithm, tells you what you should be in your career. So mine was like, you are unbelievably fast with your hands of doing things. You should be a jeweler or a gardener. So I'm neither. But I just thought that was interesting that they were, even back then, it was, you know, saying you're not good at processing and logical and rational thoughts, but you are good at practical, you know, hands-on things.
Well, talking about a jeweler, we did a podcast with a jeweler, a fascinating podcast with a jeweler. I will put a link in the show notes below if you're a listener thinking, gosh, my child or me have always been interested in jewelry. So what would you say has been the biggest reward out of all of this for you?
Linking it to dyslexia, what do you mean? Or just sort of like...
To dyslexia, yeah. What do you think? What's the biggest gift dyslexia has given you, and out of encountering the school system with dyslexia and life with dyslexia, because it gives you advantages and disadvantages. What do you think the greatest gifts?
I think the greatest gift of having dyslexia is that I look at the world differently and sometimes stumble across things that other people have missed. So I often say to children, I think as a writer, you're actually a detective. You watch the things, the world for the other, sorry, you watch the world for the things that other people miss. And then you apply two really powerful words to what you've seen. What if the footprint that you saw down in the beach in Dunbar was belonged to a magical beast? What if the door in East Linton, the little village nearby, what if it led to a magical kingdom? I think my brain is wired to look for things that other people don't see, because I've always been finding a path that other people, there's not a trodden path to get to where I want to go. And I think it's been really refreshing in terms of obviously writing, because I stumble across ideas for stories, but also for the way I view the world, that I can go out and look at it and, you know, ordinary people might just look at it and say, oh, it's raining today, at the rubbish day. I might go outside and I'll just, I feel everything so acutely. I'm like, oh my gosh, the sound of the rain sounds like dropping 10,000 marbles onto a tin tray. Or I think I'm constantly finding the what ifs, you know, what if that garden gate led somewhere extraordinary? What if this coin I found in the woods belonged to someone with an extraordinary past, or whatever it is? But I think it's awakened me probably to a sense of wonder in the world. And I think our world can look like a terrifying place full of darkness and fear and pain. You know, the war in Ukraine, the cost of living crisis, the pandemic that we're recently coming out of. And I think it's taught me to believe that there are more marvels in the world than there are sort of painful things, and that we've got to hold on to that and the hopefulness of it all. So, yeah, I think that having a brain that doesn't see things in a straightforward way, that finds ways around things, is both helpful, mental health, but also for writing books.
Fantastic. What's your latest book?
So the latest one is Saving Neverland, which this modern retelling of Peter Pan with amazing girls at the helm as well as boys. So that's the idea that the whole Neverland is covered in an icy curse, and that the island is overrun with frost bears and ice sharks and snow tigers, and the kids have to break this icy curse. But there's also a series called The Unmapped Chronicles. And the first book, I think you can see just behind me, is the pink one called Everdark. So this book has a dyslexic heroine called Smudge, and her handwriting is all smudgy because she writes left with her left hand, and it's all sort of all over the place. And she's befriended by an extremely grumpy monkey called Bartholomew. And they go on a voyage across a magical kingdom to rid this kingdom of an evil harpy called Maw. And they sail out in a boat called the Coddywomple. And I think this is a brilliant word for dyslexic people. So Coddywomple sounds like a made up word. It's a real word, and it means to travel purposefully in a vague direction. And I love that. You can really be like gung-ho, like, I want to go forward, but I don't know how I'm going to get. So to travel purposefully in a vague direction. And I thought, what a perfect name for a boat for a dyslexic child to set out on an adventure in. The fourth book in the series, the yellow one behind me, is called The Crackledawn Dragon. And a boy sets out on that in a boat called the Kerfuffle, which is similar sort of thing. But yeah, this book, Everdark, is the prequel, the first book in this Unmapped Chronicles series. Each book follows children from our world finding a portal through to a magical kingdom. So yeah, Smudge the dyslexic heroine. The book is written on dyslexic-friendly paper, so it's slightly coloured in a way that will help dyslexic readers. The font is a dyslexic-friendly font, and so is the size and spacing. So yeah, that was a really nice way of kind of like tying in a dyslexic heroine, but also with a dyslexic-friendly publishing method.
Fantastic. I love it. And so Smudge, do you refer to her as being dyslexic in the book, or is it just implied?
No, I never say she's dyslexic. Okay. Well, partly because that word dyslexic, it would jar, I think, with the adventure, because it's such a word from our world. And so I don't reference iPhones or computers or anything that makes it feel like it's our world and it's current. So I talk about her spelling being bad, her handwriting being messy, finishing bottom in the class, trouble concentrating. But these are all the skills that she needs to be the heroine to captain this boat and rid the whole kingdom of this evil creature. So it's about championing the font of being like, these are the things that matter. But in this book, Sisong, there's a character called Blue, and she's based on my sister-in-law who has Down syndrome. And on the surface of it, you might look at someone who has Down syndrome and think there's no way you could be the heroine of a story. But I never mention this girl, Blue, has Down syndrome, but I describe her in the way that my sister-in-law looks. I have her speak in the way that my sister-in-law speaks and process things that way. And my sister-in-law is one of the most joyful people I've ever met in my life. And she's taught me so much about joy and kindness. So I think she's unbelievably powerful as a human to be able to teach other people those skills. So I have a character called Blue who does go on the adventure, and she has got weaknesses physically that hold her back, but other people care for her so much, they're going to lead her through those. But she also has skills that other people who don't have Down syndrome don't have. So she is a valuable member of this team to beat this Ice Queen back. So yeah, I like having characters who maybe do have issues that might affect their performance, but that don't affect who they are as a human and how they can be instrumental in changing others' lives.
Fantastic. That's wonderful. What a great approach. Fantastic. It's just been so great speaking to you and hearing this journey. See the children that you meet in the various different encounters. There might be children listening to this, parents who are thinking, you need to listen to this podcast, this author. If there's children listening to this, what would you say to them? And what do you find yourself saying to them in school?
I would say, if they're dyslexic children, do you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd say, congratulations. You are at an unfair advantage when it comes to writing stories. You know, your brain works in a marvelous way, and it's something to be proud of and excited about. Find your way of learning. Find what helps you navigate problem areas, whether it's mind mapping or drawing a map into your story, or maybe it's finding an object and using that as a pivot point to start a story. Or sometimes I find like a postcard from a museum, always visual, you know, find something concrete that helps you and then really enjoy it. I do top three tips when I do talks to schools and children in general. And one is get outside. I think that's hugely helpful for dyslexic children when they're writing stories. If you're struggling with the paper and the words and the pen and the mechanics, put it all down, go for a walk, get outside. The world is filled with marvels, and not least to get outside because I don't believe anybody's going to get to the grand old age of 99 and be lying in their hospital bed and say, do you know what? I just wish I'd spent a bit more time of my life inside on my mobile phone. Like, no one could say that. But they might say, I'm so glad I was out there on adventures, exploring things, climbing up to the top of a mountain, whatever. So I say, get outside, be curious. The best books come from ideas that nobody else has stumbled across yet. And that's your powerful weapon as a dyslexic child, your imagination, you know, run wild with it. And the third thing is, don't be afraid to get things wrong. When I talk about 96 rejections over 7 years, 3 failed books, and it's the people who are brave enough to get it wrong who get where they want to go. So yeah, it's sort of that combination of those three things hopefully help them think, actually, this isn't a bad thing. This is an unfair advantage.
So we've talked about those 7 years where you created those 3 books. Was it 3 books or 4 books that were rejected?
It was 3.5. 3. The half I then salvaged. I basically changed it so many times to become this book.
Oh,
so Chris was another book, but it didn't work. So that's sort of 4. But there were elements of it that I changed and made it.
Oh, it morphed, it adapted into 4. I've got you.
Yeah.
So the fourth one. The fourth one was rejected at the beginning and was transformed through that process into the final book.
It was, it was an agent saying, this is interesting, but go away and rework it. So I then did. So it was
really?
3 failed books. And then it was the fourth one that took. Yeah.
So that was 7 years. How many years has it taken you to create those 11 books?
So I got my first publishing deal when I was 30 years old, and that was with the Dream Snatcher in 2015. And then I've had 1 or 2 books published every year since then.
So 7 years since. So 7 years of rejection and now 7 years of...
8 years now, yeah. So I'm 38. So in 8 years, I've had 11 books published.
Fantastic.
And 3 kids. So if I didn't have the kids, I think I might be writing faster, but I'm trying my best to kind of keep up. But at the moment, it's sort of 1 book a year. Sometimes with an additional picture book. I don't know, you can see behind me on the wall, that's the Frost Goblin. And that's a shorter book with pictures throughout, bigger format. And I'm very passionate about adults realizing that picture books can be for adults and for grown children, like, you know, 7, 8 year olds, they can, 9, 10, 11 year olds, they can still read picture books. I sometimes find they're the most clear and profound form of storytelling, like fairy tales. You know, the language is simple, the motifs are brilliant and memorable. So yeah, I'm a big fan of picture books, and sometimes I read them when I just can't really get into an adult book. I just pick up a picture book and the illustrations carry me far away, and the story, as I say, the storytelling is often brilliantly concise because they've only got 1,000 words to play with, as opposed to like 30, 40, 50,000 for a real book, for a bigger book. So yeah.
Yeah, graphic novels are really taking off.
Yeah.
Worldwide, you know, people are they've been redeemed, as it were. They're not just for kids, they're for everyone. Yeah.
I found graphic novels and comics so difficult, and I still do. And I'm interested in that because a lot of dyslexic writers say that that's their preferred method of reading. But I find I cannot. It's not linear enough, the lines, you know. Where do I go next? Do I go down here and read that speech bubble or up here? And I find it quite overwhelming. But I love, yeah, picture books where it is pictures and text. I love the pictures. It's just the leveling of it. I find my brain finds it really exhausting reading comics.
I've got you. I see the distinction you're making between picture books and
my kids love them. My kids actually love them. Actually, one of my kids, he's too young for them to know if he's dyslexic, but they say there was some processing, you know, difficulties going on. Yes. Well done. Yeah.
Fantastic. Fantastic. It has been so great speaking to you. Thank you very much for taking time in your busy schedule to share all these ideas. Is there any final words you'd like to say to folk who are listening?
No, just embrace the dyslexic kids and get writing stories. Not too good stories, though, because I don't want them to be competition for mine. But I feel when I go and speak to kids, their imaginations are so fierce and brilliant and wild. And I think, God, you know, they're coming up with ideas for stories in 3 seconds. Because I ask them, I'll give them an object like a perfume bottle, and I'll say, right, apply those 2 words, what if, to this perfume bottle? You know, what if you sprayed it on you and you became a celebrity or whatever of your choice? But, you know, they come up with what ifs, I call them ideas, in seconds. And it takes me sort of 3 months rather than 3 seconds to come up with the ideas. So I think, I think it's exciting when you meet children whose ideas are imagination, they're all fired up. So I just say, cherish the dyslexic children and know that they're probably going to be the mastermind behind the next blockbuster series.
Brilliant. Brilliant. And if you're listening to this and you want to know more about all these Abby's 11 books, we will put links to them all into the show notes. So you can just swipe up right now, click on it and go and look at some of those books.
And there's lots of teaching resources and linked to all the books as well, like themes of works and that kind of thing.
Oh, really?
Yeah, a lot of them are taught in schools. So there's lots of themes of work, lesson plans, all that kind of stuff. So I'll make sure I give you the link so we can pop them up too.
Oh, thanks for sharing that. Yeah. Oh, do you know what? One last thing was, give me your take on this as a teaching resource, okay? Your author's take. I made up this little star called the story star, okay, technique. And you draw a little star, which is the middle of your mind map. And the top one is a face.
Yeah.
The next one is eyes. The next one's a foot. The next one's a hand. And the final star branch is a crown. So you go around in a circle.
Yeah.
The face is, these are 5 stages of a story.
Yeah.
And what I did was I noticed that a lot of children with dyslexia never finished their story.
Yes. Really?
And the teachers would always come back and say, this is a good start of a story, but there's no ending. And the child would go, but I wrote the end at the end.
Yeah.
And I've written it for 5 pages. Of course it's finished. And the teacher's like, no, it's just the beginning.
Yeah.
And so what I discovered was, if you do the face, so it's the characters, 2 or 3 characters and the setting. So you set the scene. Then the eyes is, what has the hero, the one person, got their eye on? What do they want?
That's it. Yeah.
Do they want to get rich? Do they want to fall in love? Do they want to go on an adventure? Do they want, what do they want? And you, once you tell the listener what they want, then a baddie comes in and trips them up with the boot and trips them up and makes them fall. That's the foot.
Yeah.
Okay. And it's like, oh, you can't get to what you want. And what you want is the crown on the other side of the star. And so they're going to the crown, and then the boot comes in, trips you up. It's like the stones in the tree. and you smash. And then when you're on the ground, what happens is a hand reaches out into the story.
I help.
It could be the hand of a guide,
yeah,
like Gandalf or Yoda, yeah, or it could be someone who teaches you a technique or gives you a magic wand or teaches you something. And this is the hand that comes in, and the person starts to work with whatever they're given and tries to get to their goal.
Yeah.
And it starts to work, and then it doesn't work, and then it starts to work, and it doesn't work until finally they break through and they get to their crown, and that's the end of the story.
I think it's brilliant because it shows children that there's an end. And I think what they get terrified of is a blank page to a dyslexic child. I can't start. Whereas you've got those star branches, those points. Here's your start. This is what happens next. But also it paralyzes them with fear, not just the blank page and the start, but also there's no end to this. You know, I'm just going to be writing forever. Whereas if it's concise, it's that little visual, you know, that they can see how tidy it is. I think that's what it is. A lot of your brain feels so messy a lot of the time and so tangled and knotted. To see something so clearly gives you a lot of confidence. I think that's a fantastic method. I'm going to steal that and put it on your website. I'm going to
do
it.
Yes, go to the Roadmap Academy. We've got a story star technique and the map. So what I did was, as a dyslexia productivity coach, I teach executive function skills. And so when it comes to executive function skills, it's how to get stuff done.
Yeah.
So how to get a story done. And there are all sorts of different little techniques that people with dyslexia need to overcome executive function difficulties. And this whole messiness in your mind is an executive function difficulty.
Yeah.
It's not a problem. It's just a difference.
Yeah.
So, for example, use the story star. It doesn't work on its own with dyslexia. What the child has to do is they need to go through a process that works with their brain. So process number one is actually to do a brain dump of all of their ideas.
Yeah.
Like your map.
Yeah.
Or a bullet point list or a whole bunch of doodles. Okay.
Then extract those.
Then they put them into the structure. So to go straight into the structure can be too much for them because they're like, oh, no, that I don't want to go in this order. It's like, you don't need to go in that order. That's fine. Right. Let's describe the terrain. Okay. And the star is actually the points in the terrain, the beginning, the middle, and an end in the journey. You know, so this is where they all began. This is where the hero discovered a desire. They really wanted something. So that moment of discovery of the desire, then the foot that comes and trips them up. And then the hand actually has five fingers to it. So I say there's probably five little things that they have to go through.
Yeah.
That, you know, nearly there, then down, nearly there, then down. And then they get to the end. And then it's like that little pinky got them straight to the crown and the top of the mountain, as it were. Or that crown is the reward they get from the whole journey. And normally a hero who goes through a journey gets their own crown, but it's not actually something that they wear. It's more like gold. It's more like a treasure that they then give to other people in some way. They become a wise king or a leader of a team. They give back to the world. Do you know what I mean?
It's really interesting, the two things working in tandem, like the info dump of all the ideas and then the star. Because I do my map, which is like, let's just create a world. Where are we going? And then the journey on it and the plot. And then I didn't actually mention that after that, I then break down into, for each chapter, I have about 10 bullet points of what the characters are doing there in the next one. And it's like your star, and I'm taking from the star and putting it there. And then I'll often change direction. Like I'll look at my bullet point for what I'm going to write next and think, no, they wouldn't do that. But then I change my plan and then I change up. So it's all there. And I can be seeing that there's an end in sight. I say, oh gosh, I've only got a few more chapters of those bullet points to do. And it just makes it feel so much more accessible. And a story is a huge, unwieldy creature. You know, it's a big to take on. But showing children that actually, if you break it down, as you say, it's quite formulaic. These are the things they want. They spend the whole book trying to get what they want, and their obstacles are on the way. And then they get what they want. And maybe actually what they really wanted wasn't what they thought they were going to get.
It's that's the best story. You know, like someone says, they want to fall in love and there's this beautiful girl who's popular and they want to fall, they want her, but then they get tripped up and they fall. And when they get up, there's this person who stretches out, gives them a hand, and they see this person and they become friends. And actually, he fell in love with her because he was meant to fall in love with her. But he had to go through the problem to get to the real reward, is the point of every story, really, isn't it? You know, that you have to go through the trial and tribulation. In many ways, living with dyslexia is another aspect of that. Yeah. The determination that you got from falling so many times, or it being harder at school, led into you getting the reward of persisting as an author.
Yeah, definitely.
But what's fascinating when I observe children doing the Story Star is they have all of their ideas and they drop them into the star. And then I say to them, where are the gaps? And they realize, oh, there's tons of words around about the face with all the details. And then there's lots of things that are the helping hand and things that happen and so on. And I'm going, so what does the hero want? And they go, oh, I don't know. Well, obviously they want X, Y, and Z. And you go, well, you need to tell them that's what they want, even if it's one line.
Yeah.
And they write it in and they go, gosh, yes, that's what they want. And then I go, where's the problem? What went wrong? Oh, well, that's not a nice story if something goes wrong, you know.
That's life.
It's not an interesting story if something doesn't go wrong. So they go, okay, right, let's make someone really bad or whatever, you know.
Exactly, a delight in making a villain.
Yeah. And then once you've got the eye looking at the crown, you can then say, well, what did they get in the end? Oh, I don't know. Oh, well, obviously, they fell in love.
Yeah.
And then that's
not tangible.
Yeah. And that's the end. They fell in love. And wow, story ended. And so if you do that with a teacher, the teacher then says, gosh, this story has an ending.
Yeah. And you've reached that point. You've managed to get them.
A real ending. A real ending. Yeah. It's one of the most elusive things for children writing in GCSE or whatever, you know, to actually write a story with a real ending.
And also think starting as well is so difficult. And I got given some advice, start before you're ready. So you'll never feel, I think, as a dyslexic writer that you're completely ready, because you'll always think, I'm a bit nervous and it's not going to be good enough. But just dive in, you know, start before you're ready and have the ending planned out so you can see it. So it's within your grasp. You're like, actually, I could get there. And also you're gunning towards that if you know where the ending's going.
Yeah.
Helpful, because as you said earlier in the chat, a dyslexic mind will think of so many detailed things. Whereas actually, if you can focus on an ending, you're less likely to start going outwards and start describing, because you're like, hang on, no, I've got to keep it within the parameters.
Yes, absolutely. I'm going to guess that you probably take quite a lot of notes, and you showed me your notebook, but it's a common theme of people who are productive with dyslexia. It's a common theme that I've noticed with people who are really productive, is they take notes because they so easily forget things because they're thinking about next. Could you say something about this? I mean, how do you take notes?
This is good. I'm going to show you a page of my planner. My husband can't look at it. He's just like, that terrifies me. Your life is out of control. I'm like, no. And
fantastic. Show us.
So I write everything down. If I do not write it down, it doesn't happen. I forget it. It can be something huge, like, I don't know, taking my kid to school. But like, if I don't write things down, they don't happen. And as soon as I've written it down, the energy that I'm using to sort of keep that idea afloat before I forget it, I can park that energy. I can focus on the next thing. So I'm like really, really organized, but in a really like, whereas, I mean, it's just like, so I then have to get out a highlighter. And the highlighting is like book events that you've got to be in Manchester for a talk. But I mean, it's the workings of a madwoman, this.
Is that a day? Is that one day?
No, that's a day, like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And then that's the notes.
I've got you. Okay.
People's names with sketches next to them because I called them or whatever. Or I don't know. I think having children, little children as well, and trying to juggle a job I have to write things down the whole time. I have to note. I have to do, you know. And I think I spend a lot of time planning and things, but actually it means that everything goes a bit more smoothly and I feel a little bit more in control of it all. Otherwise, left to my own devices. You know, I just don't really trust my brain. I think I just won't remember things. So both with my own life and with my story, I take a lot of notes and I make a lot of notes on the computer as well as handwritten ones.
Right. With your stories, where do the notes go? Into a notebook or straight into the computers?
So at the beginning, they're in a notepad when the idea is still forming and the stories, the mind maps, basically. That's full of notepadded ideas and words I like and that I might use for names of characters or places. Like I was driving through Sussex and there was a village called Middle Wallops. And I was like, that is an amazing name. So I borrowed the name Wallops and called it the boarding school in this book. Rumble Star is called Little Wallops. And so I'm constantly, there's a notepad by my side and I'm taking notes, mind mapping, whatever. And I draw the map in the notepad. Then when it comes to, I've got this story now, this structure, I know where the journey is going. I know what the character wants. Then I go onto the computer and I type up the title of the new book and I put chapter one and then 10 bullet points, chapter two, 10 bullet points. So it's like sort of the next stage in. Then
I outline it. You basically outline it there with the bullet points.
Right. Exactly. And then I print it. Have to see it on my desk. I can't have it on a screen. I can't read books on a screen. So I can't, I don't have a Kindle. I don't, you know, do things on the screen. It has to be concrete. I have to be holding it. And like, I don't have a diary that, you know, my husband's like, why won't you share your, what does he call it? Your Google Calendar or whatever it was to me. Like, then we know what we're doing. I'm like, I can't do it online. The first to write it down.
Yes.
Drives him insane. But it's all so physical with me and visual, you know, it has to be written down to sort of, for me to remember, to me to understand. And I also think I don't like spending lots of time in front of a screen, and I have to because I type on a screen. So I quite like parking my screens. And at nighttime, I charge my phone downstairs, then I go upstairs to bed, and then I come down in the morning and my phone's there. So I never take it to the bedroom or anything. And I like that then my mind is less cluttered. But yeah, it, once the bullet points are typed up on the computer, they are then printed out.
And then do you write on the printout and highlight it and annotate it and so on?
Yes, exactly. So I'll tick off the bullet points when I've written them because it gives me such a sense of satisfaction.
So it becomes a checklist of, you know, once you've written it, once you carried on typing it, you've still got the bullet points as a checklist to tick off.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. I think a lot of writing feels unfinishable because it takes so long to write a book. It takes a year. So it's not like working in an office job where you've got to write up some notes for a conference and it takes 4 hours and you're done. Go to the conference, you've done the conference, or invoice for something, you send the invoice across, it's done. The beginning and end point of a book is so long. It's such a formless thing. You know, it goes on and on over months and whatever. So that you don't get that sense of achievement and of like, I've done it. When you get it, it's great, but it's only once a year. So I like mini successes. So when I tick off a bullet point and I've written that bit into the story, as a dyslexic writer, that feels really positive for me. It's like, oh, you're on the way, you've got that bit done. It's that mini successes. So I think, I don't know if I've got it in here. Yes, here we go. This is the bullet point note of the story I'm writing at the moment. Tick, tick. Gee, that's not going to happen. Change the name. Scribbles. Reveal that it's him. I put after Jasper Hornswoggle, the hamster called 40 Winks, who I've now said, you know, make sure 40 Winks is being featured in this chapter. So yeah, it is definitely, you know, something I use as a checklist, both for what I'm about to do and what I've done. And I think mentally it helps feel that you're making headway into a project that can feel very open-ended.
Fantastic. Oh, gosh, we covered so much. It's been so great.
You were like wrapping it up and then I was like,
We just to the whole new another section of the talk. Fantastic. Great. Well, we better stop now. It's been really good chatting with you. I know you need to get away. Thank you very much for being
Thank
here.
Thank you for having me. It's been a joy to talk.
Great. Well, I'll probably see you around in East Lothian.
Exactly. Walking your dog on the beach or something.
That's right. On the Dunbar Cliffs. You know, it's so unusual because often I have podcast guests who are in America or Australia or wherever. It's great to have someone local.
I know. It feels strange. Although it's like, I can come round to the studio if you want to do it in person. And I was like, actually, no, I've got your kids to pick up. Yeah. But no, it's so nice knowing you're local. And yeah, if there's anything I do that's a dyslexic friendly, like a talk or anything or books in the future, I'll let you know.
Great. Yes. We'll have you back on when that happens. It's been great. Thank you very much. This podcast is sponsored by dyslexiaproductivitycoaching.com. It's my day job when I'm not hosting this podcast. Tell me, do you know what you want to achieve in the workplace, but you're struggling with how to achieve it? Maybe you suspect some traits of dyslexia are getting in the way. Well, that's where Dyslexia Productivity Coaching comes in, because we give you a simple productivity system for your Apple devices that harnesses the creativity that comes with your dyslexia. It includes proven methods like note-taking, reminders, speech-to-text, mind mapping, and more, all tailored to your needs. It'll free up your time and help you achieve outstanding results. Book a complimentary call to discuss it with me, and if you do it soon, I may also be available to coach you personally via Zoom. So don't be shy, go to dyslexiaproductivitycoaching.com or swipe up and book it now.